The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The two best teams in the league play out a breathless 45, then warm down after that to leave them third and tenth respectively. Southampton and Spurs have a little go at being top before Leicester take the crown for the international break. Arsenal Twitter goes into meltdown, $14.95 cheaper and perhaps almost as entertaining as Aston Villa's demolition of Arteta's men. There's Ademola Lookman's Panenka and a great opportunity to discuss handball and offside where pointing is now banned from all football. All that plus an 11-goal thriller in the FA Cup. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. A question from Daniel. Hi, Max Rushton. Can you make sure the guy who doesn't rate Dean Smith is on the pod this week? Purely coincidentally, Jordan Jarrett Bryan. Hello, how are you?
Oh, I was great until, 16 hours ago or so. Good morning, Max. How are you?
Yeah, really good. We'll give you one game before we get into that performance from Arsenal. Greg Bukowski, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Max.
Excellent. And Barry Glendenning, always nice to see your shiny face.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Murray says, could this year's Premier League see the first ever 10-team dead heat, Barry?
No. Oh. I'm not sure if that's even mathematically possible, but and there will be someone out there who will know without having to think about it whether it is some Rain Man type. But no, I don't think so. Not in the least.
Oh. But it's nice that you know, the lead changes hands, you know, three times in a weekend and lots of different teams get to sit in the top four for a second and we can go back to the last time Southampton were top of the league and all that. Man City and Liverpool aren't top. City are actually in 10th, but they played out that 1-1 draw at the Etihad. Greg, I mean, like I said in the intro, like the first half was so quick. It petered out a bit after that. Do you think a draw was the correct result?
Yeah, I think the draw was a fair result. But just to get on to the speed of that first half, it's got to be the most intense 45 minutes of football I've seen since, you know, crowds weren't at stadiums. And I thought that's kind of testament to the players for being able to motivate themselves and play at such speed in an empty stadium. And also the managers as well for, you know, motivating the players. And, you know, and a lot was said before the match about, you know, whether Pep is still... he's able to motivate his players in the same way, and I think it was obvious in that game that he was, and to kind of deal with what was a ridiculous Liverpool formation for the first 20 minutes. It was a 4-2-4, which I don't think football's seen that since about 1897, particularly in a game like that. I thought he did so well to tinker with his team and kind of, you know, managed to nullify the threat and then find space in behind Liverpool. So it was such an enjoyable first half to watch.
Do you think the second half petered out because they were knackered or just the game went sort of more tactical, Greg?
I think partly both. I mean, the speed they played the first half, but they must have been more knackered in that second half. But I think tactically, you know, the managers had then spoken to the players and probably had a word and said, you know, it's still early on in the season here. We don't necessarily have to try and win the title, you know, after 10 games of the season. And I just think he, you know, tactically and probably the players were grateful to maybe not be going hell for leather like they were in the first half as well.
What did you make of it, Jordan?
I enjoyed it. I agree with Greg. I think the first 30 minutes in particular, the speed and the intensity was from Liverpool more so, I thought was really, really impressive. I was really intrigued by Jurgen Klopp's decision to crowbar the usual front three and Jota in. I wanted to see how that played out. And I just wonder if there was an element of thinking from Klopp that he thought, you know what, if we can win here, I know it's early in the season, I know it's early, but I wonder if he thought we could actually potentially blow City out of this title race even at this stage. I know they've got a game in hand still as well, but I wonder if his thinking was to just really go for them, just finish the game, win the game, and try and put some kind of a lead between the two teams. That didn't happen as it played out, but I was really impressed with the front three. I don't think it really worked after the first 30 minutes with Jota as the fourth attacker there personally, but I thought it was a good game. I was also looking at us player camming just briefly, Laporte, because it's generally, I'll tell you why, it's generally, I think, conceded of agreed amongst most football fans and pundits that he's probably the second best centre back in the Premier League. But I thought to myself, is he the second best centre-back in the Premier League? Or is the gap between him and Virgil van Dijk so big, it's almost like he's the top of everybody else? And in which case, calling him the second best defender in the Premier League is almost a discredit to Virgil van Dijk. And I thought he played okay, but I do think he's miles off of Virgil van Dijk. But no, generally, I thought it was a really good game. Enjoyed it. Fair results. And I think City will take a point and try to put some kind of run together to close that gap.
Is player cam still a thing? I thought
it is in my head.
oh, I see. It wasn't like you just started watching Laporte. You didn't have a special button to.
No. Just me personally. I was just watching to see how good he actually is and how big the gap between him and Van Dijk is.
I remember when Emil Heskey went to the A League in Australia, they had Heskey cam for like half a season. I mean, there aren't that. I would pay just to watch target men hold the ball up and flick it on. Barry, your thoughts on the match?
Yeah, like everyone else, I really enjoyed the first half. Second was quite tedious by comparison. I thought it could have gone either way, so draw was probably fair. I think maybe at halftime the players came out for the second half and they said, sort of, you know what, there's no one here, we're in the middle of a pandemic, we're tired, everyone's going to be talking about offsides and handballs, one of which was in this game, and those who aren't talking about that will be celebrating the American presidential election results, so let's not bother, what's the point? But yeah, it was a very good game between two very good teams, and no one was more surprised than me, I have to say, to see Kevin De Bruyne miss that penalty, except perhaps Kevin De Bruyne. I did not foresee that happening.
Do you think Kevin De Bruyne was being altruistic because he's not a fan of the handball law? I guess we might as well talk about this now. We can bring in the Leicester one as well, Kilman handling that ball. And
I think the problem isn't with the handball rule particularly. It's the combination of the handball rule and VAR. So the problem is largely with VAR. If we didn't have VAR, half these handballs wouldn't be noticed, they wouldn't be given. But we have VAR, the curtain twitchers in Stockley Park are obliged to draw the referee's attention to them. He goes to the screen at the side of the pitch, watches it at a hundredth of its normal speed, and therefore has no option but to give the penalty. I'll be honest, I thought the one against Joe Gomez was probably fair enough. The one in the Leicester Wolves game, not so much, because the Wolves defender didn't have the option to pull his arm out of the way because the ball was hit with such force from point blank range. But the problem is not really the handball rule, it's with VAR. But the whole thing, I was sort of thinking about this last night. I don't really care if teams are getting penalties they shouldn't normally get, because who doesn't like a penalty? Penalties liven up games. A lot of these games are awful because they're being played behind closed doors. And if we get a penalty, I'm wholeheartedly in favour of it.
The problem is that it's going to change the way football's played, though, isn't it? Where you're going to have teams practicing dinking the ball up onto defenders' arms, you know, in the penalty area in training sessions, because it is such an easy, cheap way now to score a goal in the Premier League. And I don't know, you know, if all these fantasy teams, all you've got is probably people just picking penalty takers, because you just know. I mean, I don't know how many penalties Mo Salah scored this season. I think he's had quite a few. And you
well,
know.
Leicester have had 8 penalties this season already.
Yeah, so I mean it's kind of ridiculous. And if you do, you know, if football does become players choosing not to shoot in the area or do something extravagant because you can just chip the ball up onto some fella's elbow, it's just crap, isn't it?
Yeah, I like, Greg, how you've got to the real nub of the problem, which is the impact on fantasy football. But okay,
he's right though.
What about this? I was thinking about this yesterday because I was so annoyed with that penalty, and that, you know, Gary Neville on commentary in the UK was right. He was like, you know, the referee, it was Craig Pawson, wasn't it? He doesn't want to give it. He's sort of looking reluctantly. He's gone, oh, I've got to give this one. Why don't we just say, unless it's stopping a goal, right? The punishment doesn't fit the crime, right? Gomez's hand is out a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't give it as a handball. I'd say play on. But if you're going to penalise it, make it an indirect free kick. Because you're right, a penalty is too big a... that is too big a punishment. It's too big a reward for just kicking a ball into someone's arm when it's on the edge of the box, Jordan.
And who doesn't like an indirect free kick?
Exactly, yeah, I totally agree. What do you reckon, Jordan?
I just wonder if at what point on shows and television programs and podcasts we're going to stop crying about this. The fact is, most people don't like it. I'm actually like, I'm at one with it. It's the way we're going. Some people don't like the fact, as Greg mentioned, that you'll get to a point where players will just start chipping balls onto people's hands. You're going to get a lot more penalties. But we are where we are. I've felt for a while now where we are here because previously football fans, football pundits, football people were not mature enough to accept that referees make mistakes. So now we've gone the other way where we're so clinical, we're so scientific with what we do to give a penalty, or sorry, with a handball, that we're now giving them for everything. So now at least you know when you walk onto the pitch, if it hits your hand, it's going to be a penalty, rather than wondering the referee today, is he going to give it, is he going to not? It's not great, but at least we know where we stand with it.
We should probably move on. Arsenal nil, Aston Villa 3. Ed says, is it contractual now to have Jordan on after every Villa win? James, who's more wrong about Aston Villa and Jack Grealish, Gareth Southgate or Jordan Jarrett-Bryan? Pearson, how many goals does Jordan Jarrett-Bryan think Arsenal would have lost by if Villa didn't have an inept Football League jobber as our manager, smiley face? Alan Shearer called it the complete team performance. If Villa were walking down the road, they would be John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, said Ian Wright. Jordan, Dean Smith, tactically inept, somehow spawnies a 3-0 victory at the Emirates.
If there's one result that would... this is so bad. Okay, so I'll go Villa first. First of all, credit to Aston Villa. I thought they were fantastic, led by Dean Smith. Mm-hmm. I thought there was so much energy and intensity from the front three. I'm really liking Douglas Luiz. I thought Jack Grealish was brilliant. I'll give him credit. I thought he was really, really good. And not even the best player on the pitch. I thought Ross Barkley was phenomenal and ran Arsenal ragged. I like Aston Villa more than I like Dean Smith. I'll go that far. I think they're a good team. I think with a better manager, they could do even better. But I'll give them credit. Fair play to them. I think what they did tactically very well, which I will give credit to Dean Smith for, was they pinned Arsenal's fullbacks really far back. It was all game. I was saying to Arsenal, push up 10, 15 metres more. But Arsenal couldn't because they were just being pushed back. They couldn't get out over the halfway line. On Arsenal, I thought they were dreadful. Everyone knows I'm the biggest Arteta cheerleader on the planet. It was disgraceful. I will give him criticism for this result because he set them up wrong, in my opinion. A couple of players I wouldn't have started with who he did. And he's got to be very careful now because the Arsenal fan base doesn't take much to set them off. So it's not a great result going into the international break. And there's a lot of work there still to do, for sure.
Jordan, who do you think is a better manager, Mikel Arteta or Dean Smith?
You're on a wind-up, Max. I think Mikel Arteta. I think he's the best. I've seen more from him that makes me have faith that he can do a better job with Arsenal than I've seen with Dean Smith at Aston Villa.
From experience as well, I would say being thrashed by Aston Villa isn't the worst thing for a season. Liverpool haven't lost since.
I thought Villa were brilliant, weren't they, Barry? I mean, like the patience for the first goal. At points, like during that move, Barkley and Grealish were sort of like boxers with their opponent, like ducking and weaving, just waiting for the moment. Ross Barkley's volleyed cross for Watkins' goal was brilliant, and Grealish, that wait for the pass for Watkins' second goal while he's sort of being barged over, I just thought they were utterly brilliant all over the pitch, Villa.
I thought they were brilliant on the ball, brilliant off the ball. I think this Grealish-Barkley combo, they look like they're having so much fun playing together, sharing the burden of creativity. Douglas Luiz also excellent, but Grealish and Barkley look like they're having so much fun. I know one swallow doesn't make a summer, but I think if I was Gareth Southgate, I'd be keeping a very close eye on Aston Villa this season to see how that progresses, because if they could play like that in England shirts, it would be irresistible. But their goals were outstanding, and then when they didn't have the ball, when Arsenal were trying to get at them, they just shut everything down brilliantly. Arsenal, again, lacking that killer pass, lacking a lot, but lacking that little bit of creativity. Everything looks so choreographed to the very inch by Arteta. It's as if the players aren't being allowed to express themselves. Again, think of Mesut Ozil trawling them from afar, liking various tweets posted about Arsenal's performance and the fact that he wasn't playing. You just have to take your hat off to him for that. But absolutely splendid performance from Aston Villa.
Just on Arsenal, sorry, just very briefly, what annoyed me was that he went with a very defensive setup. You can't play Partey and Elneny in that system and concede three goals. I can forgive Mikel Arteta for lack of creativity and not scoring goals, but you can't lose 3-0. The whole point of having Partey and Elneny is to ensure that you are solid and you get ripped to pieces 3-0 at home. It's not a good look for Arteta at all.
Yeah, I'm sure they were probably in there to maybe go man-to-man on Grealish and Barkley between the lines, and they just didn't manage to do that. But yeah, I thought Grealish and Barkley were just like playing free jazz football. It was lovely. It was a bit of a throwback.
Jordan, just quick question, which is it just stubbornness now?
I'm in too deep, Max. I'm in too deep. No, listen, Dean Smith's doing a good job. I would admit that he maybe isn't as bad as I painted him initially. I'm still not fully in on Dean Smith. I'll judge him over the 38 games. I think tactically yesterday he wiped the floor of Mikel Arteta. I will say that. But let's not forget their last two results. They lost 4-3 at Southampton and they lost 3-0 at Leeds. So let's kind of keep some perspective.
Let's go to Goodison. Everton 1, Manchester United 3. Worth remembering, Greg, going into this game, it's pretty much as soon as we stopped recording the pod, actually, all these rumours that Solskjaer had gone and Pochettino was in, and you know, Jamie Jackson was really sweating on this because he's just released his Ole Gunnar Solskjaer book. He says, please stay there until Christmas. It's really hard to get a read on Manchester United, isn't it? I mean, this was a good performance. They played well. They might not have won it, but they did well.
I think he got it right not playing Pogba, which a lot of people thought he would do because he didn't start in midweek when they were awful in Europe. And he has had good results when he's needed them in the past, and he does seem to be able to get his players to step up. I thought he got it right. McTominay and Fred offered a really solid base in midfield, so Fernandes could then go and be the player that Paul Pogba was supposed to be when they signed him. He's like this talismanic do-everything midfielder. And I can honestly see a similar situation with Pogba as there is with Ozil at Arsenal, where he's a player who's got talent but just doesn't seem to fit now. And they've tried many times. I know he's had injuries, but I just think probably better going forward to try and stick with a regular 11. And the one they put out against Everton did a very good job. Although I do think Everton helped him slightly by playing Rodriguez when I don't think he was fit. I think Ancelotti said before the match, he's not 100%. He probably shouldn't play, but he's told me he wants to, so he will. And I was like, well, is that the best management, really, if a player's, you know, if that's your feeling about a player? And he didn't really do the work that Everton needed him to do, and they got overwhelmed in midfield at times after they went goal behind.
It was a great header from Fernandes. I mean, it was a match-winning performance from Fernandes, wasn't it? A great header, really unselfish for the third. You noticed that Marcus Rashford is so nice. He saw the ball was going in, so decided not to touch it because he just wanted to be even more giving on the pitch as well as off the pitch.
Well, somebody clever on Twitter made the point that it should be Marcus Rashford's goal because it went in off his halo.
It's really good. I mean, you wonder if, you know, Solskjaer just does enough to keep his job. Like, it could go on for, this sort of purgatory could go on forever, Baz.
Yeah, it certainly could. International break coming up, you wonder if they had lost that game, would he be gone? A pragmatist might ask, would it be wise just to get rid of him anyway? But I don't think they will do that. I don't think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is solely the problem at Manchester United, but he's the most easily solvable one because the chief executive isn't going to get the bullet by the looks of things. But yeah, they win, they draw, they lose, they win, they draw, they lose. They're just going around in circles as far as I can tell. But I thought it was a very poor performance by Everton. I'd echo what Greg said. I didn't realise James was injured, but he didn't. Everyone has talked about how brilliant he's been for Everton, but what you get in brilliance you pay for in his unwillingness to track back. Now, I hadn't factored in his whatever injury it was that Greg mentioned, while sort of musing about this, but it was quite obvious Manchester United were making a point of sending all their attacks down the left. Seamus Coleman was getting overwhelmed because James was doing nothing to help him.
What did you make, Jordan, of Solskjaer afterwards talking about this fixture congestion? It's a shambles. I cannot praise the boys enough for the character they've shown. That's all I want to talk about. Those boys deserve better than being thrown out here to fail today. The authorities set us up to fail. This is obviously putting them at the early kickoff on a Saturday after they've played Champions League on Wednesday. I think Jurgen Klopp afterwards was saying sort of similar things and saying, look, it's not fair on Tottenham to be the midday kickoff on a Sunday when they played on a Thursday. Do you think, you know, the managers' unions are right to get together and say this fixture, where the picks are put, is to set up the theatre for the fans, or is that just not?
Yeah, I mean, I'm more in the camp of get over it. It's not ideal, but I think if you're the Manchester United manager, you have to accept you're going to be playing lots of games in a very short period of time. Obviously, with what's happened with the pandemic, games have been, you know, truncated even more. And the way I see it is, well, the television companies are paying pretty much you guys' wages. So they will dictate when the games are played. It's not ideal. It's not great, especially with the lack of the preseason as well. But I just thought it was the wrong time for him to show a little bit of, you know, show some cojones. I thought it was the wrong time for him to kind of be on the front foot. There were other things, there were other fights I think he should be looking to fight, i.e. upstairs internally, before taking on the authorities and their schedules. I just think, get on with it. You're Manchester United manager. You're going to have lots of games in a very short space of time. You should want that, because that shows that you're in many competitions and doing well. So I didn't have too much sympathy for him in that sense.
Just to finish on this, a nice tweet from Bernard after his goal saying, a finish that deserved to count for something, at Bernard. But he tagged a different Bernard in. He didn't tag himself in. He tagged a Canadian skydiving enthusiast. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Stamford Bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Stephen says, what's everyone's plans for Monday night? Robert says, how many hours until Football Weekly Live? Yeah, apologies to anybody who follows me on social media for my 72-hourly scheduled tweets. But we do have a live show tonight, 7:30, if you're listening to this before the pod. If you're listening afterwards, you can still buy a ticket after it's finished and watch it any time over the next week. And in many ways, Barry, like a fine wine, this live show is bound to get better and better as the days go on, isn't it?
Well, it is, except it may be taken down within 7 days because we're bound to grievously offend somebody so much that they will demand, or they or their legal representatives will demand that it be taken down. So ideally watch it live.
Absolutely.
Or as soon as possible afterwards.
Yeah, me, Barry, Wilson, Barney with you tonight. We're very much looking forward to it. Chelsea 4, Sheffield United 1. Jordan, Chelsea are definitely good now, aren't they? I think they are.
Definitely, I don't know. They're in a very strong period of form at the moment. Frank Lampard seems to be learning in how to shape defensively his team, not just his back four and keeper, but the general team. They've conceded less goals in the last couple of weeks. He's getting the balance right of looking defensively solid, but also not taking away from the front men as well. They seem to be enjoying this last couple of weeks playing a lot more football as well. But in regards to being title contenders, I think that was always the intention from above anyway. So I think he's just now kind of stepping into and fulfilling what the remit was anyway.
Who's a better manager, Frank Lampard or Dean Smith? No, you don't have to answer that one. Hakim Ziyech, Barry, was absolutely brilliant, wasn't he?
Yeah, I was thinking, watching this game, my recollection of him playing for Ajax was mazy dribbles down the wing and then putting in crosses, whereas now he doesn't seem to do that so much. He's decided, I won't bother dribbling, I'll just swish my wand of a left foot and place the ball wherever I want to. He was absolutely outstanding in this game. I thought Mateo Kovacic also stood out for me, but yeah, it was very much the Hakim Ziyech. So his delivery, I can't think of anyone who I've seen consistently deliver crosses or balls from deep better than him, except perhaps Kevin De Bruyne, who has been doing it with monotonous regularity for seasons now.
What about Andy Hinchcliffe?
Well, yeah,
Who is your favourite swisher? Who's your favourite swisher of the left foot of all time?
Crikey. I'd have to go with myself, really, I think.
I mean, you don't have to. Let's just be clear about this.
Well, I'm going to.
Okay.
Can I just add to Barry's point there that Chelsea have got so many good set-piece takers. They've got really good deliverers of the ball. James, Chilwell, Havertz, Alonso. They've got lots of really good crosses and passes of the ball in their squad. Just thought I'd mention that.
Absolutely. It's a good thing to have in a football squad, isn't it? Hey, helps. Greg, question for you, Greg. And maybe a silly question. On form, would you rather Chilwell and James or Robertson and Alexander-Arnold?
Robertson and Alexander-Arnold on form, just because I think Trent bests everybody. You know, like he's ridiculous. You're talking about like the swishing of the left boot. The swishing of the right boot from Trent is incredible. Like he's just, you know, that injury he got is such a blow for Liverpool, because when Liverpool haven't been creating, he is the player who's come forward and done the job of the midfield. So he's on another level for me as a fullback.
We got told off last pod, I think, Barry, by some Sheffield United fans for sort of misanalyzing the problems, and some fans who watch Sheffield United every minute of every game suggest the problems are down the left hand side. I tried to look at that in this game, and I just decided there were just problems everywhere. Really?
So, how did we misanalyze them?
Well, I think we just said our second season syndrome was a problem, but actually, there were, you know, they've got injuries, they're missing players.
My recollection is that you did all the analysis last time, Max, and talked about second season syndrome. I didn't say anything.
All right, okay.
I thought
we win awards together and we sink with this ship together, Barry.
No.
I see, it's very easy. You just throw me out as soon as you possibly can.
Well, if we're being criticized for a lack of accuracy, I think it's only fair that I accurately assess the criticism.
Well,
right.
Actually, the criticism was aimed at Philippe Auclair, and I defended him because he's one of the team, unlike what you have just done.
Well, if you had asked me about Sheffield United last time, I was going to interrupt, but you moved on and we were short of time. I would have said, yes, injuries have a problem. I think they're seriously missing John Fleck, although I would argue he wasn't really in form before he got injured. It was noted on Match of the Day a couple of weeks ago, and I'm not just copying them. It is something I noticed during... I can't remember who they were playing, but their reluctance to cross the ball into the box was just ridiculous. And they've got Ali McBurney in there, who I don't rate as highly as some, but he does cause centre-halves bother, and he's good in the air. If he's there, why not use him? There is a Twitter account I follow called BA Analytics. It's, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, run by a complete tactics nerd who is a Sheffield United fan. But the reason I love his account is because while he does this incisive analysis of games, he also is a fully card-carrying, tinfoil hat-wearing conspiracy theorist. And I love the combination of cold, hard, steely analysis and... complete when it comes to his team, just howls of bias. And I saw that he was predicting that the media would be writing off Sheffield United, condemning them to relegation. I wouldn't be quite ready to do that yet, although if they are going to get themselves out of the current pickle, I think they'll have to do something only one or two teams has done before in regards to the number of points they have. But they're not making as many tackles as they used to. They're not as energetic as they used to be last season. They're not getting balls into the box. And unless something changes, I think they're in big, big trouble. Chris Wilder... has said, not recently, but in the last few weeks, he said, there's nothing wrong with my system. The players just aren't on it at the moment and they're not using the system properly. I wouldn't be so sure about that.
If any of that analysis is wrong, at B. Glendenning on Twitter, you'll know, obviously, that I don't trust any goalkeeper in short sleeves, and don't tell me about Iker Casillas. Still don't believe it. But Dean Henderson wears a sort of one of those sort of tight undershirts. So even though he's got a short sleeve top on, it does look like he's in long sleeves. Aaron Ramsdale, short sleeves. And I think that is a big, big problem for them. Leicester City are top of the league. They beat Wolves 1-0. Jamie Vardy at it again. We've discussed the handball and the penalty. I think Leicester fans will probably be slightly frustrated. It's taken this long to get to them, Jordan, when they are top of the Premier League. It's no mean feat to be top of this division, even if teams are dropping points. And Brendan Rodgers has got them doing very well.
No, he's doing a great job. I think Leicester are a strong contender. I think everything from Liverpool downwards, so I think they'll win the league. I think second, third and fourth is really open. I think Leicester, actually alongside Wolves, are one of the teams that I think could easily finish above the likes of Arsenal, Chelsea and United and break into that top four, stay in that top four in their case. I think they've got players with pace. There's power there. Rodgers is... he's got some fantastic results this season already. If you think they've beaten Arsenal away, beaten City away, it's another one they've won as well, away as well, another big result they've had this season. Now they've beaten Wolves. I think Leicester could do some real damage this year if they can keep Jamie Vardy fit, which he seems to, you know, very rarely seems to be out injured. So I think Rodgers deserves, gets a lot of flack, some from me, but I think he deserves a lot of praise as well for how he's managed to make that team seemingly his team now. And I think they're a team that could finish top four.
Sorry, are you giving praise to a manager?
I am. I am. Yeah. He's done well. He's done well.
what do you reckon, Greg? It's very hard. I know it's early in the season. It's very hard to discuss contenders at this stage. They do have a nice balance about them, I think.
Yeah, I think, and you know, the performances are consistent with what we saw last season, with a very, you know, good start to the season. They obviously dropped off, and that could be a problem again if they were to get too many injuries. As Jordan said, Vardy rarely gets injured, but then when he does, perhaps the drop off down in quality is a bit too much to for them to deal with. But I think Rodgers, because of his many Brentisms, like, you know, he does get more criticism than he deserves, and he's such an adaptable manager. He does make, you know, lots of in-game tactical changes to deal with situations. And he's always very keen to tell everybody that he's done so afterwards, which, you know, maybe makes people not like him so much. But he's a really good manager. He's still, you know, young and finding his feet, really. He's, you know, could be peak. I don't know what the peak for a manager is. If a player's peak is 27, is a manager's peak 50 or something? But he's still got it.
I don't know. I mean, we'll get on to Roy Hodgson in a minute. Yeah. And, you know, maybe he hasn't even peaked yet. Let's go to the Hawthorns. Tottenham were top of the league for 90 minutes in a truly miserable way of spending $14.95, speaking from experience. Harry Kane's 150th Premier League goal, deft little header. It was a mistake by the West Brom goalkeeper, I thought. But four straight away wins for Spurs. Finally, Gareth Bale, Heung-min Son and Harry Kane start up front together, and not a whole lot happened in this game. But like, for Tottenham to be top of the league for 90 minutes in a season is, you know, it's quite an achievement. Does anyone have anything else to add to this game? It was a pretty painful game of football.
I would like to talk about West Brom, if I could.
Sure.
And the reason I want to talk about them is because we're 8 games into the season and I know nothing about them. They're like the Premier League's dirty little secret, that the mutant child hidden down in the basement. And it's not their fault. But they're hidden away on pay-per-view. I never get to see them play because I'm not paying to watch them unless I absolutely have to. And I just wonder what it is that West Brom, newly arrived, promoted, as much right to be in the Premier League, have done to deserve this, what can only be described as a shunning. It's like the rest of the Premier League had a meeting behind their back. And we know that Premier League teams do this and decided, you know, we don't want West Brom in our gang. Let's shove them behind a paywall. I think it's 4 or 5 games out of 8 so far. You know, I couldn't name 4 West Brom players. That's how, you know, it's like they're not there. They're in the league, but they're not in the league. And I'd love to be able to wax lyrical about their many shortcomings, but I literally do not know a thing about them.
Do you think there's two WhatsApp groups with the Premier League, one with all 20 and one with 19 and not West Brom? And then you have to be really careful that you're typing in the right one when you're not typing. You're like, oh no, quickly, suddenly, you know, Aston Villa delete a message for everyone because it was meant to be in the non-West Brom group.
I mean, I know Sid Lowe got in trouble, all sorts of bother on Twitter a few weeks ago for sticking up for West Brom, and loads of West Brom fans took it to mean he was insulting him. And I'm worried this might happen here. I mean, West Brom, no disrespect whatsoever. But it does seem like they are the Premier League's dirty, embarrassing little secret. And I've no idea why.
I enjoyed Bilic getting really angry in his press conference on Friday. I don't know if you saw it. I mean, again, probably nobody saw it because it was behind, maybe it was a pay-per-view press conference that he did. But there was loads of rumours on Friday that he was going to be sacked and Lee Bowyer was going to be installed as manager. I don't know where they came from. And it obviously got wind of them. And he did have a point. He said, well, everybody said we're going to finish bottom and get relegated. And we're third bottom and we're a point off, you know, survival at the moment. So that's about par for what we are. And, he's got a point. And I think, you know, they're not expected to go to Spurs and win, are they, or get a point. So, I don't know. We need to just lay off West Brom, I think.
Barry, if you have a notebook there, you could write down Conor Gallagher. He's one of the 20 million players that Chelsea have out on loan. But watching West Brom yesterday, I thought he really looked like quite a good player. Dogged, determined, decent on the ball, hit the post. He was really unlucky with the shot that hit the post from outside the box. So there's one. You need to find three more. Surely, you know Jake Livermore's there, right? He's been there for 200 years.
Oh, is he still right? There? Yeah.
You got
is Paul Robinson still in goal?
No, he's not. Did Paul Robinson play in goal for them?
I think so.
Did he?
Well, maybe he did. Oh, I'm thinking of the other North. No, I am thinking of Paul Robinson.
Are you thinking of Brian Robson there, Baz?
There you go. Anyway, I'm sure you have upset some West Brom fans.
Well, that's certainly not my intention.
After the that doesn't get people out of being cancelled, Barry. After the international,
if I'm cancelled in West Bromwich, I'll cope.
There we go. After the international break, by the way, Spurs play City, Chelsea, Arsenal, Palace, Liverpool, Leicester. So that's not an easy run. Southampton were top of the league as well. Bristol Saints says, please, can you mention the fact that Saints were top of the league for the first time since 1988, albeit for 24 hours? Only students of the game and Saints fans will realise just how significant that is, given their fluctuating fortunes over those 32 years. Yeah, they went down, didn't they, to League One at one stage. The last time they were top of the league, Chris Nicholl was the manager, I think. Letitia was playing. In fact, I spoke to him on the radio on Saturday about it, and he was saying, actually, they would have been top for another week, but they had a goal disallowed at Highbury, and it was an absolute disgrace. So he's not over that 32 years on. Southampton tweeted, stop the count after this game, as they were top of the table. Hasenhüttl said, anything is possible this season. Jordan, is anything possible this season?
Anything is possible this season, Max. After Mikel Arteta, I'm probably my favourite manager in the league, probably is Ralf Hasenhüttl. I am a big fan of his. I think there's a bigger job in the next year, maybe two, waiting for him. I love managers that are able to adapt around circumstances that go against them. So losing key players, I think losing Danny Ings, he's found a way to keep the goals coming and keep the fluidity of their attack still working. In answer to your question again, I can see them finishing in the European spot this season. I like the way they play. I think Theo Walcott going back there is, without being a cliche, he's gone back home, and I think he feels at home there. I feel that that's his level, a mid-table Premier League side. Defensively, they're looking a lot better as well. So, no, I'm a big fan of him. And, there's no reason why they couldn't finish in a European spot this season.
Paul Robinson, youth career York City and Leeds United. Played 95 times for Leeds, 137 times for Tottenham. One goal, if you remember. 189 times for Blackburn, 3 times for Burnley. 41 England caps. Although, Barry, Paul Robinson, the left-back, did play 214 times for West Bromwich Albion between 2003 and 2010. So you're allowed to get your Paul Robinsons mixed up, as long as you don't get those two mixed up with the evil, nefarious owner of Lassitus. right, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin at Selhurst Park. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Crystal Palace 4, Leeds United 1. Let's start with the controversial point of this game. Michael says, how should strikers show where they want to the pass to be played? Now pointing carries too much of a risk of offside. Is pointing your tongue in the direction of the pass an option? The commentator on Match of the Day said he's definitely onside. This is Patrick Bamford, who signalled where he wanted the ball. The pass was played perfectly. He timed his run perfectly, dinked it over the keeper, would have made it 1-1. He was given offside after a VAR check. Bamford said, it's daft. I don't know what to say, Greg.
Yeah,
can you help?
Yeah, just like offside was invented to stop people from goal hanging. And it's not doing its job. It's become ridiculous now in that it's just preventing perfectly good goals. I mean, why aren't assistant referees being asked to flag for offside? Because that's causing injuries as well. Plays continuing, defenders think plays continuing, so they overstretch and could get injured. It's just gone far too far. And I know so much has been said about this, but I personally think it has gone to the point now that, you know, Bamford didn't have an advantage for what he was doing, because his feet were about half a body behind the defender. I mean, so that's not doing what the rule was invented to do, which was just to stop people hanging around in the penalty area and just waiting for someone to lump the ball up to them so they could score.
So what's the solution?
I think to possibly go back to having assistant referees flag for offside, and it goes to VAR only if a goal is scored and there's a clear and obvious offside, which for me should be a full width of a body past the defender, because that would be an advantage perhaps that was unfair. But otherwise, I think even if a player is half offside, I think defenders have still got a chance of being able to make a tackle. It's just so depressing, because you can't celebrate any goals anymore, can you? And that's the point of football, isn't it? To get a bit of joy.
Gareth said, yes, the VAR decision was stupid, but Palace beat media darlings Leeds while scoring 4 goals and now being in pole position for the Everton Cup. Any thoughts on Roy Ball? He has a net spend of minus £27 million since joining. Might be the only negative spend in the league. Jordan, wax lyrical on Roy Ball.
I won't wax lyrical on Roy Ball, but I am scratching my head as to how he's getting this brand of football out of that side. There's some young, exciting, attacking players in that team, but he's doing a lot better than I expected, and I can't quite put my finger on why, apart from having good players. Obviously, he's a very experienced manager, but yeah, I might have to pass this one over, because I can't, watching them, I can't work out how he's getting them to play this type of football. It's weird for me.
Can anybody? I mean, all I know about Roy is what you hear is that they spent hours and hours doing sort of mind-numbingly boring shape training sessions where they just all, it's just drummed into them where they have to be in the right place at the right time all the time. And he has these sort of willing soldiers, the McCarths, MacArthur and McCarthy, just they're really good at being in the right place at the right time. But he's got some...
I don't think you can understate or overstate how important the McCarths are. They work very, very hard, and they're quite unglamorous, and they're not big names. So I suppose that maybe could be some reason why they don't perhaps get the credit they deserve. Also, Crystal Palace aren't this good every week, and often aren't anywhere near this good. But when you have a front three of Berici, Ezzy, who I must say I'd never really heard of. I remember saying to Jacob Steinberg, I think during the summer, who is this guy? And he couldn't believe that I'd never heard of him, but he somehow bypassed me completely.
Like the whole of West Brom.
Well, and QPR are a bit like that too. I mean, the last time I watched a QPR game, I think Les Ferdinand was up front for them. But him and Wilf Zaha and Jordan Ayew, who I must say I'm still not convinced by, but he's doing all right. They're a good front three. They're going to give any side problems.
West Ham 1, Fulham 0. Chris says, who looked more absurd on Saturday? Rudy Giuliani in his Four Seasons Total Landscaping car park press conference or Adamola Lookman with his Panenka? On the press conference, Barney says, I reckon Rudy Giuliani's Four Seasons press conference is actually a nod to his love of the Carabao Cup draw. But that penalty, oh man, I've watched it so many times. Because Adamola Lookman, a bit like Gabriel Jesus, looks like he's going to cry at all times anyway. But like, it was really sad for him, but it was also absolutely hilarious. Any penalty where the goalkeeper can dive, get up again, and just catch the ball. It's just...
I find it really hard to watch cringe humour, you know, like Borat and all those things. I can't watch them. So I've only watched this penalty once, and I had to press pause as soon as I saw what he did, because I just couldn't go through with watching it. I didn't want to see what the reaction was.
Pat Nevin writes, Baz, I'm so offended some people suggested the Lookman penalty was worse than mine for Chelsea v Manchester City. Unacceptable slander. His reach to the goalkeeper. Surely I can keep the worst ever crown. The Nevin penalty is an absolute thing of beauty, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think Chelsea were well ahead in that game when he did that. So it didn't matter. Lookman's cost his team what could be an unbelievably precious point.
Who was the incredibly slow run-up and then booted it over the bar?
Neymar did that for Brazil many, many years ago. One of those little kind of... Yeah, and I've seen a few of them, but I know Neymar did one.
Zsa, is it? What's the guy called?
The Italian Zsa.
Zsa, yeah.
And he was brought on specially to take a penalty.
Simone Zsa. I don't know why I called him Zsa, like Zsa Gabor. Do you remember Zsa Gabor's penalty just after Diana Ross's was absolutely shite?
The thing with the Lookman penalty is he surely practices penalties in training and is the best at them. But there's no way he practices Panenka penalties in training because your goalkeeper would just save them all the time. So what the hell was he thinking?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Brighton 0, Burnley 0. Rich says, can we have an in-depth analysis of Brighton v Burnley? Actually, scrap that. I can't do this anymore. Can you just not mention how shit we are this week, even though you have every right to, as we are, in fact, shit? Yours, every Burnley fan. Greg.
I had to sit through that because, for some reason, decided to do it as a kind of minute-by-minute report on the end of the Friday football blog. So I did actually watch 90 minutes of that game, and it was... It was pretty atrocious. But Burnley, I mean, they just have too much meat up front. You know, like, you play one of Chris Wood or Ashley Barnes, but you don't play both. I mean, it's like, I've got this meat stew. What does it need? Needs something extra. I know. Let's lob another steak in there and a bit of lamb and some bacon as well. It's like, what are you doing, Sean Dyche? It's far too much meat in your stew. Just stop it. And weirdly, it worked against Brighton because they're like some kind of weird, I don't know, kind of vegan footballing team who are just far too nice and don't want to score goals in case they offend somebody. So that was kind of how it was.
In the Championship, just to note, I said Reading were good a couple of weeks ago. Since then, they've lost all their football matches. they're still top, though, because they had such a great start. Familiar look of the teams below them, Watford, Norwich and Bournemouth. And the FA Cup, from Martin Hardy in the Times, AFC Wimbledon are furious that the FA refused to allow them to wear a special badge in recognition of the 1988 FA Cup triumph achieved by their predecessor club, Wimbledon. Sleeve badges issued to teams taking part in this season's competition from the first round onwards make reference to how many times they've won the competition. I mean, that is not reading the room, Barry, isn't it? Unless I'm getting this wrong, this seems like a really sort of jobs-worthy... no one would be annoyed if they wore it. Everybody appreciates that AFC Wimbledon are basically Wimbledon, even back at Plough Lane now.
Yeah, there are more important things going on in the world at the moment, but it seems very petty that presumably every FA Cup will be remembered, for want of a better word, on someone's sleeve, but not the 1988 Cup final, because the FA can't decide to give it to... whether to give it to MK Dons or AFC Wimbledon. MK Dons have given the trophy to Wimbledon. They've said, right, it's yours. You won that, not this incarnation. So if MK Dons are able to do that, I don't see why Wimbledon, why the FA can't. And if you go Well, I obviously haven't been to Plough Lane, but at Kingsmoor, where Wimbledon were playing, it's a real old school clubhouse, but they have all these cabinets up with memorabilia in them, and a lot of that memorabilia relates to the 1988 FA Cup final. I think Vinnie Jones's... I think, well, the box in which his medal came is there, but there was no sign of the medal, so I don't know if someone nicked it or if he only donated the box or if they'd put it away for safekeeping, because it would have been easy to nick. I think his jersey is there as well, but there is a lot of memorabilia. That is their cup final. No one's denying that, except apparently the competition organisers.
I mean, it would be ultimate shithousery from MK Dons if they put that badge on their shirt, wouldn't it? Greg, you wanted to mention a couple of your former clubs in the FA Cup.
Yeah. So 25 years ago, Marine were last in the first round of the FA Cup and they went away to Shrewsbury. At that time, I was playing for their youth team. I was 16 and we were all quite excited. We had a game that day. I can't remember who we were playing. We were excited that Marine were going to Shrewsbury, you know, could do something special. They lost 11-2. And we all just sat around thinking, well, you know, we probably could have done a better job than the first team there, you know, hoping we might get promoted. But this time round, this was the 25 years later. This is the next time they've ever been in the first round. They are now playing in the Northern Premier League, which isn't considered elite. It's the eighth tier, so they're not allowed to train. They've not got any competitive games, but they were allowed to compete in the FA Cup because that's considered elite. So they went down to Colchester and drew 1-1, went through extra time, got to penalties, and Michael Howard scored the winning penalty, which is an incredible result for them, where they are as a club. And now they're in this situation where they're in the second round and they're not supposed to be able to train. So I don't know what... I imagine the government are going to have to come up with some kind of solution that the teams who continue to play in the FA Cup are considered elite whilst they're still in it and therefore can train. And it's a shame because without any competitive games, I can't imagine they're going to be able to compete in the second round. But it's a wonderful result for them. And then another team who I once turned out for their reserves some years later, who did very well in the first round, is Chorley, who were playing against Wigan. And I know Wigan are on the downers themselves at the moment, but they are, you know, they're above Chorley by about, I think, four divisions. And they went down 2-0 at Wigan and fought back to win 3-2 in the second half, which is an incredible fight back. So good on them as well.
And well done to Barnet, Boreham Wood, Dagenham, Redbridge, Solihull, Moors, Stockport, Darlow and Ian Culverhouse's King's Lynn. Torquay 5, Crawley 6. It was a completely ridiculous game of football. They were 2-0 down, Crawley, in normal time. There were 20 minutes of injury time because a goalkeeper got quite badly injured. He's okay, though, I think. They were 5-3 down in extra time, eventually won 6-5. And obviously, we'll all remember where we were when Joe Biden became president. I was on an exercise bike watching Shrewsbury knock Cambridge out on iFollow. Gillingham Tannoy announcement, according to Tom, watching Gillingham Woking on iFollow. The stadium announcer, only speaking to the players, said called a substitution with Joe Biden coming on to replace Donald Trump. Anyone read Wrexham's mission statement from Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds? I mean, they just sound like the greatest new owners of a football club. If it all goes through, our goal is to grow the team, return it to the EFL in front of increased attendances at an improved stadium while making a positive difference to the wider community in Wrexham. They then had hard promises, of which every third promise was always beat Chester with an asterisk. And at the bottom said, if we ever play Chester again. But really saying all the right things about a football club. So it'll be great if they do turn up. That's pretty much it for today. Barry, any thoughts?
Well, I just have one thought. With regard to my Paul Robinson, Rick, I was actually thinking of Scott Carson. So there you go. Who is now reserve keeper at Manchester City?
He is. Excellent.
So I just wanted to clear that up.
No, that's fine. Have you got any more West Brom players? Can you think of any more?
Saeed Berahino. Brendan Batson, whose niece occasionally appears on the podcast with us,
yep.
Anne-Marie.
Yep.
She'd be very upset if I left out Uncle Brendan. Mm-hmm. And Gary Megson, and that's all. I'm out.
Okay, wonderful. Look, thanks for your time today. Thank you, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Greg.
Cheers, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
See you all for the live show if you come to that. If not, we'll be back tomorrow. Archie Rintut, Nicky Bandini, Lars Sivertsen will join us for a European round.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.